Tonight on Arena, Hypnotic, 406 Days, The Little Mermaid and Sisu are the movies up for review. And Paul and Dom from Bellex One on the new album, Mercyful Hour. Five one double 51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. And we start this evening with film reviews. First up, 406 Days, documentary focusing on the longest dispute in Irish labour history, directed by Joe Lee, to whom we spoke last week. Then we'll go to Sisu, a fantasy World War II action movie from Finnish director Jalmari Helander, with obvious comparisons to a certain Quentin Tarantino, a movie set in the same war and similar type of story. Third movie tonight is Hypnotic, comes from director Robert Rodriguez. You might know him from films like Dusk Till Dawn and Sin City. The cast here is led by Ben Affleck. And finally, if all that action and gore isn't your thing, Halle Bailey in a live action adaptation of Hans Christian Andersen's fairy tale The Little Mermaid, in which she plays the title role. Chris Wasser and Gemma Cray have been watching the films for us, and they're with me in studio this evening. We'll start with the Irish production, 406 days, the 406 days of the title, referring, of course, to the number of days former Debenhams workers picketed the 11 stores which had been shut by the company in April 2020, making all of those former employees instantly redundant. I suppose that is the kind of story behind it, Chris. How does Joe Lee go about telling this story?
He goes right back to the beginning, to April 9th, 2020, when almost 1,000 Debenhams workers, people who'd worked on the floor for maybe 10, 20, 25 years, received a generic corporate email to say all 11 stores in Ireland were going to be shut. Your jobs are, you know, no longer exist. Mm. And redundancy packages that might have been discussed early on in their careers will not be offered. So you had people's, you know, livelihoods and lives just ruined with a single email. There was no personal messages, no phone calls, no discussions with bosses. And in fact, staff members here, so the staff members who used to work for Debenhams, they bring us back and they talk about how in the weeks leading up to this decision, you know, the world was almost ending, you know, around us. We had the beginning of the pandemic, and the staff were called in to put away stock, you know, so some of the high-end stock, you know, your Levi's jeans, your perfume. And they were thinking they were putting them away because looting was on the way. Yeah. But they were actually putting them away because Debenhams was preparing to sell the stock.
Okay. And the focus here very much is on, in terms of Jodie's interviews, is on those workers, Gemma. But it's also on the community that existed, and well, it still exists. The workers are still pals, it would seem.
Pals and activists. So as you can see with this film, they are going to a number of screenings of Q&As. There was a screening in the Dáil with TDs present. They're really fighting a case against I think it was KPMG or Debenhams in the Workplace Commission. Slightly went their way. They've been fighting for the right so that this doesn't happen again, because another thing that the film covers is how systematically this was planned, how it was orchestrated by KPMG, how a load of the company's debt was hoisted onto the Irish leg of this.
Yeah.
Everything else was kind of sold off, and it was really left there like a severed leg.
That's the story as we're told it in the film. And when I spoke to Joe Lee, I asked him, did he speak to any of the other parties involved? And he said no, he wanted to focus on the workers. So that is the story that we're told here. But that sense of community is there from the very beginning, really, for me. And I just love this section that goes around several of the workers across several of the branches right around the country. And you get a sense from them about how important their work was in terms of their own lives.
I started working for Debenhams in 1996 when they first arrived in Ireland.
Somebody said to me, Debenhams was coming in. So I just applied and I got the job. They did all the interviews in Croke Park. So I was put into the sports department.
When I started in Roaches in April, I think, of 1993. So between Roaches and Debenhams, I had 27 years service.
I was 30 years there when we actually closed. I went in as a summer job after my leaving cert and I never left.
I was working in the restaurant the whole time. Started off over in the Jervis. And I was working there for 22 and a half years altogether.
A wonderful family atmosphere in Debenhams, the Square Tala. Everybody looked out for everybody. A lot of people stayed in that job 20 odd years. We had our babies together, we had our christenings, we had our weddings.
I started off for 11 years in the wedding gift service. That's what I did for 11 years.
I had my husband and I had my family, but I also had my job, and that was Michelle. You know what I mean? That was my whole life.
And that's a clip from Joe Lee's film 406 Days, some of the workers in Debenhams who in fact picketed for 406 days. But the nature, you referred to them, Gemma, as activists. The nature of what they did was incredibly brave in some cases to make sure that that stock did not leave the various stores around the country.
Yeah, because that was their leverage to their to the redundancy that they were owed. And again, redundancy that they argued they had given up their rights as workers. They had given up perks of the job so that they would be guaranteed this. So they, you know, they think in the middle of COVID when everything is kind of falling down around them that they're going to at least have that
agreed amount. Yeah, it was so, 2 plus 2 weeks plus 2 weeks, I think, was the agreed thing that they kept going back to. But if you get a sense of it in that clip, Chris, how there were communities in the various shops.
Yes.
But what Jolie's film, where it really succeeded for me, was when he then broadened that out to write the branches right around the country, and it became like they became like cousins as opposed to brothers and sisters working together in one store. It was cousins working all around the country.
That's true, because it's an angry, you know, determined film, and we're talking about something that made an awful lot of workers very angry and determined to, you know, to have that redundancy that they were promised. But in coming together throughout that strike, you know, you can feel the sense of warmth and the sense of community and family that emerged from this terrible thing. I think what Joe Lee's film is very good at doing, and we heard that clip there, by the way, in that clip, you see the deserted department stores.
Yeah, he got to film in the empty store itself. That's it. Which adds a huge amount.
And at one stage as well, you see the workers returning to that empty space. Mm. And it's one of the few times as well where there's an almost eerie cinematic quality to this documentary. But I think what it's very good at doing is assembling and revisiting what is actually an historic episode in Irish history. And one that, well, we followed it every day throughout the pandemic. Sometimes it took second or third or fourth billing. And we can't be, you know, it was a weird time for everybody. You know, the dominant story was the pandemic, but you know, it was always there in the background. And sometimes it feels as though this happened years ago, but no, this film has actually been released 2 years to the day since the strike finished.
Yeah, and the other aspect of it was, I think it was by the time it got, they had managed to get some stock out of some of the stores, but by the time they got to Limerick, the other stores had contacted them and they all sang Limerick, You're a Lady out on the streets of Limerick, which I thought was a lovely touch.
It celebrates the small wins. It celebrates the humanity of people that are there. It's a really great documentary because even though you sort of know the highlights of it, it takes you through the painstaking moments, the celebratory moments. Like at one stage they break into one of the buildings and occupy it, and it's a very kind of almost comical scene where someone just left the window open and they just got in. They had come to great plans, brought ladders. The ladders was too short. So it really kind of took you through it moment by moment. And there were so many peaks and troughs in that time that it makes for very, very good watching.
Stars from you on this one, Gemma?
4. Brilliant.
What are you saying overall, Chris?
I think a little bit, if I can remove the subject matter for a minute, I found it a little bit repetitive. I think there's a very good 60-minute television feature in there, but I thought it was a little bit choppy. And this ticking clock, ringing bell that rings, that motif that runs all the way through the film, that was a little bit distracting.
Yeah, because it keeps counting up the days towards 406.
Yeah, it took away from it rather than added to it. So it's an admirable, commendable piece of work, not without its flaws, but I'm glad that Jolie made it. So
it's an important
film, yes.
Important story to be told. 3 and 4 stars respectively there for 406 days. Let's move on then to Sisu from director Jalmari Helinda. Sisu centres on a grizzled former soldier turned gold prospector who runs into a bunch of nasty Nazi soldiers, an encounter you feel that might well end worse for the group of Germans than the sole Finlander in this particular case. My first question, of course, neither of you will be able to answer because there is none. What does Sisu, is there a translation for that Finnish word Sisu, Gemma?
Yeah, there's no direct translation, which they do say, but there's a bunch of different words they use to describe it. So determination, tenacity of spirit, purpose, grit, bravery, resilience, and are very interesting. Autonomy, the lead character is a very intense kind of quiet soul who embodies all of these things when he's pushed to the edge, as those Nazis are very soon to find out. He starts off with his dog and his horse, a man who's one with nature. He happens across a huge part of gold and he runs into that violent brood of Nazis as he's trying to, you know, cash in his winnings on the way back. So they see him as an old man. He's not a threat. They initially go to let him go. But all of a sudden, when they steal his gold, well, then, you know, he's coming back and he's determined to get his money back.
Get his money back. So is there kind of a revenge story at the heart of this? Quentin Tarantino is an obvious parallel here for several reasons, Chris. How big is the parallel between this film and Quentin Tarantino?
Yeah, I could see an awful lot of Inglourious Basterds in this film. And I'd love to know what Tarantino might make of it, because it almost plays out like an homage to Tarantino films, but also spaghetti westerns at times. And what I mean by that is you have these pointed, frazzled chapter headings. You've got this, you know, ruthless tale of a loner who, you know, won't back down when the bullies are after him, or in this case the Nazis. You know, you've got the pitch black humor that's kind of bubbling underneath this grim surface. It's very Tarantino-esque, but that's not necessarily a bad thing.
And violent, like a Tarantino film might be?
Extraordinarily violent. The inventive kills here are something else. It's a difficult film to argue with, though, because you're starting off with a story where this retired commando is basically putting some manners on some rotten Nazis. That's 5 stars straight away. You come down from that. So you're on board with this guy all along. But the way that it explains itself is quite good, because it could have Hellander, the director, he could have bogged himself down in, you know, trying to explain the Lapland War, what was going on with the Germans at the time. But no, it's just, look, these Nazis know that they're going to lose. They see gold, they see a way out. They think, we'll take it from the old man, and the old man has a secret pass, and he says, no way, and killing starts.
Yeah, that's how it goes. So Askell Henney then plays Bruno, who is the tank commander. He's one of the Nazis here. Jack Doolin is Wolf, one of the tank crew. And Wolf is telling Bruno here that about an order they have received from headquarters, and Bruno is not altogether happy. Little bit of language towards the end of this clip.
The general, he has given us orders. Turn back and head to Norway from Finland immediately.
Did you tell him he just killed 7 of our men?
I did.
And?
He thinks we were lucky. Lucky. The dog tags belong to a man named Artemi Korpi. He was a Finnish commando, the most feared in his unit. The general said, and I quote, "He's one mean motherfucker that you do not want to mess with." He fought in the Winter War, lost his home and his family to the Russians. He became a ruthless, vengeful soldier who took orders from no one. The Finns, they gave up trying to discipline or control him. They just sent him out alone into the wilderness to hunt Russian patrols. He became a one-man death squad. The reports are unconfirmed, but it looks like he has over 300 Russian kills. The Russians, they gave him a name. They call him Koshai, the Immortal.
There you go. Clip from One Man Death. Actually, not a clip from One, a clip from Sisu, where we get this, that line, One Man Death Squad. It does sound as if the best thing that the guys could do would be hand over the gold and get out of there as quick as you can.
Oh, but they would. They don't.
Because, be no film if they did that.
Yeah, it would be very short. But also Bruno is a very kind of low-key performance of
this
of
is the Askell Henney performance. Yeah.
Yeah, so it's really restrained. He's a great chemistry with Jack Doolin, who's the second in command as Wolf. And like that, like between them, there's a bravado, like a very kind of subtle alpha male bravado that's kind of driving the whole thing. So when they go, oh, we can take that commander, no bother, that's no threat to us.
And we got a sense in that clip as well. It is, as Gemma was saying, Chris, it is so underplayed there, and just the sound of the boat underneath is kind of tinkling away. But then that music comes in. I think you were quite taken by the score, or does it say telling us what we should be feeling?
It is telling us what we should be feeling. The minute you hear that ominous soundtrack, you think, well, this is not going to end well for the lads in the tank now, is it? And also, like, I love how the one of the Nazis in the tank got all that information from one quick phone call. But it gets a little bit too ridiculous as it goes along. We have, I think the invincibility of the protagonist as well. It's like, okay, I don't know if he could survive all of this. And there's this climatic fight sequence on board a plane, which kind of lost me. But it never tries to be anything other than what it is, which is this ultra-violent, gory B-movie, you know, one-man revenge yarn. Mm. It's brilliantly performed. I thought actually Hellander made the most of a small, but well, 6 million, but it's a small enough budget for the story that he's trying to tell. So despite its flaws, I had some fun with this.
All right, so you had fun. So what are you saying in terms of stars?
I'm going to go with 3.5 stars, actually. Yeah, I mean, it's just it just gets a little bit too ridiculous towards the end, and I think I've been put off a little bit by Hellander talking that he might franchise it. Don't do that. Leave it at this one and done. Yeah. It's better that way.
Yeah, well, the guys didn't give back the gold, so will Hellander listen to you for that one, Chris? What are you saying overall, Gemma?
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. Definitely, don't franchise it. It was celebrated. I celebrate the win and move on. But it's good characters. It's a good examination of the world. It's so silly in that John Wick way. I go 4 stars because it's beautiful.
Okay, 4 stars. That's pretty. 3.5 and 4. Pretty even Stevens from the two of you there. All right, back to films now. And Chris Wasser and Gemma Cray still with me in studio. Let's go to Hypnotic next. Austin, Texas is our location here. Hardened cop Danny Rourke is attending his shrink, trying to come to terms with the disappearance of his 7-year-old daughter, Minnie, some 3 years earlier. Hypnotic is directed by Robert Rodriguez, stars Ben Affleck as the aforementioned Danny Rourke. You've seen this one, Chris. Mm-hmm. It's not arriving on our shores with lots of stars all over the poster, is it?
No, not at all. Robert Rodriguez has his fans in Ben Affleck too, and you know, he had a recent success with Air, which is a far superior film to this. But this film opening in America had the worst opening of Rodriguez's and Affleck's career, and I think the finger has been pointed at Warner for lack of marketing. And they might be right, actually, because I think the press screening invite coming in for this was the first that I'd heard that Affleck had a new film only a month and a half after we last saw Air. But still went into it with an open mind. He plays Danny Rourke, as you said, hardened police detective, has never gotten over the disappearance of his daughter 3 years previously, an abduction case that remains unsolved. But he goes back to work with a little help from his therapist, and on his first day back, himself and his partner Nix, they receive this anonymous tip off that there's going to be a bank robbery. And so this stakeout ensues. They follow this mysterious stranger who seems to have these odd mind controlling powers over everyone in the bank.
Diana Cruz's character, is it?
This is actually before we get to Diana Cruz, right? This is William Fichtner's character. And so Affleck's character follows this guy into the bank. He follows him to a safe deposit box, and what he finds in the safe deposit box is a picture of his missing daughter. That unleashes this whole puzzle box of a case. We come to Diana Cruz, who's this fortune teller.
Right, we'll listen to Diana Cruz, because she kind of picks up on the...
She'll explain it.
There's been a tip-off type of thing. Here she is talking to... This is Diana Cruz's Alice Braga, talking to Ben Affleck.
What makes 4 total strangers pull off an elaborate bank heist on a whim?
I'm guessing you're going to say Lev Del Rey. Why don't you tell me who he is? What does he have on these people?
Are you familiar with the concept of hypnotic constructs?
Look, lady, come on. First it's fortune telling, and it's hypnosis.
It's not hypnosis. Hypnotics have abilities far beyond anything we have a name for.
Hypnotics?
People with the ability to actually influence the brain over a psychic bandwidth.
Like telepathy?
Telepaths just read the mind. Hypnotics reshape its reality. The guy at the bank. You said he spoke 4 words to a woman in Shundrest.
Because she was in on it.
No. Those are cues. Sound, voice, locking eyes. Hypnotics use them to make you see a version of the world that doesn't exist. Your behavior conforms with this hypnotic construct, so everything that you see and do feels perfectly normal.
How is it that you know so much about these hypnotics?
Because I am one.
I never would have guessed. I tell you, when you're explaining, you're losing.
Yeah. Yeah, it's
I should say that's Alice Braga as or Diana Cruz as Alice Braga, or is it, that's it, yes. And we also heard Ben Affleck still having a very low Batman voice.
He does, yeah.
Barely recognisable, actually, vocally anyway.
Yeah, he went a bit too far with the voice in this. Robert Rodriguez says that he wrote this film back in 2002 and that he's been sitting on it since. And that's a shame because in that time, you know, this film actually starts off as a thriller, but it devolves into this dodgy sci-fi. And in those 20 years, we've seen Chris Nolan, for instance, do far better things with similar ideas.
Inception being, I suppose, absolutely. A case in point.
It's almost like Rodriguez watched Inception and Memento and said, I can do that. Well, you can't. And unfortunately, the film, it's loaded with that kind of exposition that you heard there. It's quite awkward. It's constantly trying to outsmart and out-twist itself. It just ties itself up in knots. And the performance too. Poor Affleck, he can't hide when he's disinterested in a role. And, you know, it's so obvious here that something's gone wrong.
Even his star power won't save it then, is
absolutely not. I mean, it is cool that, you know, you've got this, you know, movie star going for an original piece of work. But, you know, everyone involved has done better and you expect more from them here.
Stars.
It's worst of the year pile. It's one star.
One star?
Yeah. Sorry about that.
Not usually your style at all, Chris.
No.
So it must
moving
be,
on.
It's clearly, I am. Sorry. I'll keep going. Yeah, don't put that one on your list. I think it's the message that Chris Wasser is stating loudly and clearly. Let's go on then to the Disney remake, a live action Disney remake. This time it's the Hans and Christian Andersen fairy tale, The Little Mermaid. Halle Bailey, you kind of have to say the name three or four times to get your head around it. Halle Bailey is the woman as Ariel, the mermaid, who, despite her father's orders, is fascinated by the human world that exists beyond the water's edge, particularly a prince named Eric. It's the Little Mermaid. What can you do with the Little Mermaid other than just tell the story, Gemma?
Well, they pimped it out a little bit. They delved into the backstory of sirens and the siren song. They've added a few songs. They've updated some of the lyrics so that they're less anti-consent-y and modernised a few things. They've kind of, poor Flounder has been demoted as the best friend, and now Awkwafina has taken more of a role. They're very tiny little structural things. Oh yeah, for some reason Prince Eric has given his own world and arc. Like, actually, it's quite a long plot, and obviously half of it went into developing his new, like, actual proper character.
So Prince Eric and the Little Mermaid, it's kind of equal billing here, is it?
Yeah, he has his own kind of arc. Like, they try to kind of set them up that they're both people from different worlds looking for different things and trying to explore. Now, they do, it's a very interesting juxtaposition for a number of gendered reasons. I don't know if that's like a conscious choice from there, because Prince Eric is given a boat by his wealthy mother to go exploring and buying things, stealing things. Meanwhile, Ariel is horribly controlled by her King Triton and bullied and supervised, like the Sebastian. Like, it's actually quite an interesting take on two people from similar situations and how that gender plays into it. But I don't necessarily know if that was conscious.
All right. Let's listen to a clip with Halle Bailey then, as Ariel goes for help to the outcast sea witch. This is a character called Ursula, played by Melissa McCarthy. And of course, Ursula has a deal, but there are snags with the deal.
The sea witch!
So here's the deal. I'll whip up a little potion to make you human for 3 days. Got that? 3 days. Before the sun sets on the third day, you and Princey must share a kiss. And not just any kiss. A kiss of true love. If you do, you will remain human permanently. But if you don't, you'll turn back into a mermaid. And you belong to me.
You're still trying to work out. Obviously, you weren't listening. You fell asleep when Hans Christian Andersen's story was being read. You're still trying to work out the deal there.
The deal is a bit weird. It always has been.
Yeah. Or Melissa McCarthy and Halle Bailey there as Ariel in a clip from the Disney remake of The Little Mermaid. At any rate, Melissa McCarthy is having fun with that. And there's a 36-second clip that does more than the other clip that we played at 1:18. It tells us an awful lot very quickly.
It does, yeah. I mean, there are huge flaws with this film, but the two performances, Halle Bailey's performance and Melissa McCarthy, are quite good. You know, Halle Bailey, who was the subject of despicable racist backlash when this film was announced, when the casting was announced, it was just horrible stuff. She is a delightful performer here, and it helps too that she has an awesome vocal, and that the big musical numbers, I think, Part of My World, like, they're you know, she's so suited criticism. But if everyone in this film was having as much fun as Melissa McCarthy is, it would be just a much more enjoyable endeavor. She is kind of playing up. She's almost treating this as though it's the camp Christmas pantomime that it should be, and she's having a blast with it.
Yeah.
And I just wish Javier Bardem and, you know, Prince Eric Iona Howard King, the guy who's playing him, they tapped into that, or that they'd all met beforehand and said, let's do something like what Melissa's doing.
Yeah, and Rob Marshall is the director here. He's well known as a director of musicals. The music and songs are, I mean, everybody knows those, I think, probably from the original, but they've been reimagined here by Lin-Manuel Miranda of Hamilton fame, etc., etc., and the original composer, I think, Alan Menken, involved as well. So does the music work? Does it kind of tap into the fun,
yeah,
Gemma?
It does. I mean, it's really enjoyable, and it kind of feeds into a different problem where the film itself is really, really long. They've added in a new musical number for Eric, new raps, new kind of set pieces. So it all elongates a film that's already sort of very unfocused and goes in a lot of direction, especially when it's aimed at children, and even the themes are quite adult. So it's, I don't know, like, even though Rob Marshall is incredible, his musical numbers are always beautiful, I think actually a bit of reservation would have served the subject matter a little bit better.
So did it work, or are you just going to go back and watch the 1989 animated version again, Gemma?
I think there's a lot in it that's good. It's a visual spectacle. Disney are never going to go too far wrong, but it's actually, for me, just really disappointing for that.
You wanted more.
Yeah, I think as an adult watching it, I'd probably give it 2 stars. But if I'm bringing the kids and they're enjoying it, maybe 3.
What are you saying, Chris?
I thought it was lifeless and pointless, as a lot of these Disney live action remakes are. I just think that there's no, like, The Little Mermaid was an 80-minute film. It doesn't need to be 135 minutes, you know, with live action performers. Javier Bardem in particular was terrible in it, and I usually love Javier Bardem. But no, it's not very pretty to look at. The musical numbers are a little too drawn out. It's just, there's far too much of it, and it's far too stilted and convoluted. Great stuff out of Halle Bailey, great stuff out of Melissa McCarthy, but everything else is just very watery, Sean.
Yeah, he had a bad time at The Little Mermaid and a bad time at Up and Naughty.
Not a
poor
great
Chris.
Week. Not a
stars,
great week.
Stars from you on that, finally,
I'm
Chris.
I'm going to go with 2.
Something you wanted to say quickly,
oh,
Gemma?
Oh, yeah, I'd say if I'd watch a spin-off of Ursula.
Yes.
Like, I would absolutely
so we're all, we all want the Ursula spin-off.
The
Ursula spin-off.
Yeah.
Okay, that's fine. So Hypnotic, The Little Mermaid, Sisu and 406 Days, Gemma Cray and Chris Wasser are reviewers today. Back with Bell X1. In the 7 years since their last record, Arms, Bell X1 have been busy with other creative pursuits. Paul Noonan formed Houseplants with Dahi, while Dave Geraghty released another album under his Join Me in the Pines guys. Now they're back to the mothership with a new 10-track album, Merciful Hour, and a series of live shows around the country this summer to celebrate their 25th year. The album has a thread of unexplained throughout and is described by Paul Noonan as a sort of spooky, slightly unsettling quality. With me in studio this evening, Paul Noonan and Dominic Phillips. Dom, I think I should be calling you Dominic.
Hello.
Rather than your mother would want me to call you Dominic at least once. But let's go with Dom. Are you responsible for the Merciful Hour? Merciful Hour.
Merciful, kind of. It's a bit of, yeah, a bit of been thrown around a bit.
Yeah, because this is the title.
It's certainly
of
a feature from my grandmother certainly would have used it as a phrase.
Yeah.
And so we've sort of reinterpreted it as a different thing, but it's very much, you'll say it to the odd person and it'll go, I know exactly where that came from, kind of thing. Yeah,
yeah. And was it a specific track or a specific moment when this utterance came out?
Just in general, I think we're kind of feeling it kind of encapsulates the whole feeling that we have, or the whole process and everything that's been for the last year or a couple of years.
I thought you were going to say last 25 years, because I was wondering to what extent, Paul, do you think it is? I mean, 25 years is it kind of when you add it all up. Really, has Bell X1 been around 25 years? But we are all of an age now where it has been.
Yeah, I don't really have a sense of it being, you know, when you put a figure like that, it is a long time for sure. But you just kind of roll and do your thing and put one foot in front of the other. And here we are. Yeah,
yeah, so you take one step at a time, and before you know it, you've been walking for 25 years. It's kind of what you're saying. Let's have a listen to a track called Spacewalk, because there are a couple of bits of the lyrics here that really, really caught me in respect of the 25 years. Let's have a listen.
Sometimes it's hard. It's hard to be near them. Arrange a face to greet them. Sometimes it's hard. It's hard to be near them.
When I went led into that, Paul Noonan, saying about the 25 years, I mean, to me, it kind of jumped out about how happy you were to be, you know, questions, are we actually making a living? Is this a way to make a living at all, writing songs and playing in a band? But you're on a spacewalk, an enjoyable spacewalk, I'm guessing.
I mean, this... It's probably the song is a little darker in some ways, in the sense that as we do this living and get to a certain age, you find, you know, life stuff, friends get sick, you know, you start encountering, you know, natural sort of decrepitude, and in a way that the invincibility of your 20s has fallen away, and it sort of it can. When you first encounter it, it can really, you can feel really walloped, and it can feel like an outer body experience.
There's a hint in that too, of, you know, seeing people that you care about, more or less on the flat of their back, is what you're talking about there.
Yeah.
There is a hint that it's not all upbeat, even though the song itself, as you were saying as we were listening, is probably the most upbeat on the album.
I think we've always liked to play with that sense of sort of juxtaposition between the spirit of the music can not necessarily telegraph what the song is about. We try to sort of be a bit, little more subtle than maybe we were in the past along those lines.
And the other thing that I think has come in on this album, particularly the presence of Dowry Strings, is that the title of the string players who are alongside you there, Dom?
Yeah, we did a song with them, it's years ago now, I think it was like a charity gig or charity song, and it was great and we really enjoyed working with them, so we kind of said, oh, maybe we'll do a few more, and we ended up prepping a gig which we toured like several times, and kind of reimagined the old catalogue with strings kind of thing. And then over time, we started played a few new songs, which we put strings on purpose and kind of brought them in from the start. So it kind of really informed this record in that we wanted to have strings on it as a fundamental from the start, as opposed to normally you'd make a record and we go, oh, now we'll get a string section and we'll layer it on top.
We'll add something into it. So what does that mean then in terms of potential live performance, or indeed maybe you've done some live performances where you've been playing the songs anyway? Does that mean that you bring the strings with you, or how is that working?
Yeah, we did some semi-acoustic string shows and then we played some of the new songs as we were kind of bringing them on. So the strings informed the songs, but we haven't played like a full band show. These summer shows that we'll be doing will probably be reverse engineered in that they'll be full band shows without strings.
Yeah.
But it's just another way to work them,
yes,
which is kind of part of the challenge, or part of the buzz, to see something flipped or to do something with a different slant.
Yeah, and just the songs become something else in and of themselves. I know that Dave Gerty takes the lead vocal on a couple of the tracks,
yeah,
and I'm thinking particularly of Whisper in the Night, which has the strings are very important in this one.
Yeah.
Now, while Dave isn't here, is this his song, or was it your song then sings, or how did that work? Paul?
It's very much his song, and we consciously left a lot of space in the song for strings to be quite dominant in, and I suppose it's the really evocative nature of strings composed and played by humans. You know, you can't replicate that with synths and with software. And it's one of those songs that was just incredibly satisfying to see through in that way. You know, Aina Brennan, who's the wonderful composer and leader of Dowry Strings, composed the strings and we recorded them with John Spud Murphy, who produced the record with us. And it was just one of those, being in a room with a quartet playing is the most incredible spine-tingling thing. It really is. And that's why we kind of really wanted to lean into the strings with this record and leave that space and have them involved from the ground floor as opposed to retrofitting strings into the songs, you know.
And I guess that is a very different process. You know, Dom was touching on it there, that this idea that, yeah, you write the songs, you're the rock band, and then the strings are kind of added into it. When you have the strings there from the beginning, did it really switch the kind of the process, process?
Certain songs definitely were, you know, we had to kind of stop ourselves finishing things and just leave that space for Aina to jump on.
Yeah, well, let's have a listen to Whisper in the Night, which is a wonderful, wonderful quality to it and wonderful emotional openness in what Dave is singing about here. It's just really struck me. But Whisper in the Night from the new Bell X1 album, Merciful Hour. Absolutely beautiful stuff. Whisper in the Night, a track there from Merciful Hour, the new Bell X1 album, which has been released tomorrow. Dave Geraghty, the lead vocalist on that particular song. With me in studio this evening, Paul Noonan and Dom Phillips. I suppose, Dom, as you listen, as you were listening there, you were talking about things kind of being, the more you heard the strings, the less you wanted to do.
Yeah. When we were playing the shows with them and playing the older songs with strings, and you sort of hear what they're bringing and you're kind of going, oh, I just want to hear that. You do a sound check and it would be just the strings. They sound check the strings and they'd play like half a song.
Yeah.
And we wouldn't touch it. You know, I wouldn't even have the bass on.
Yeah.
And it'd be like, oh, listen to that. Well, maybe the whole gig should be just that. Yeah. Maybe we do. And even a couple of songs like Defector. It was
early on, yeah.
It was mainly strings with us just doing little flickers here and there, like. But
And I guess, but that takes courage as a band member to say, do you know what, I should step back and let this
happen. But then we had, you know, we played the stuff so many times, I guess, that it was refreshing
to hear something else
and then go, oh, that's amazing. So. Let's just do that.
And I was even listening there in terms of you obviously on bass, it's there, but I was listening to the rhythm section, if you like, the drum. There's just this little tincture of cymbal way off in the background. It's there, but it's very delicate, Paul, and it really opens up. And for me, in that song in particular, opens up an emotional quality that's really haunting.
Yeah, I think that a thread we wanted to run through the record is that sense of sort of otherworldliness and that sort of widescreen quality that strings bring, and sort of tapping into sort of more magic realism, I suppose, or being sort of quite sort of visual about the things that we're talking about in the songs as well, like A Whisper in the Night. You know, for me, that, I mean, Dave wrote the song, but it has that sort of Space Oddity vibe to it. It has that sort of untethered, drifting in space quality to it.
And you're talking about visuals there as well. I suppose you can't get much more visual than when you start describing the colour of something. You might explain Haint Blue.
Yes.
What exactly Haint Blue is.
But I see this as a sort of foundational song with the record, in terms of, it was one of those early meetings that Dave and I had where we shared things that we'd been working on. And he had been listening to a podcast about hoodoo culture in parts of the southern US, which I suppose was transported from Western Africa with the slaves. And they had this wonderfully rich hoodoo culture with these sort of ghosts and demons and boogie characters, one of which was the Haint. And the lore went that if you painted your porch a certain shade of blue, that the Haint wouldn't be able to see your house and would leave you alone, would float on by. Mm. So it's this particular kind of shade of light blue that still to this day a lot of porches in that part of the US are painted. I just thought it was a wonderfully sort of evocative story and a great jump-off point for the song.
So was that a jump-off point for you then when Dave described this to you? Did it send you off to the writing?
Yes.
And that's often the way between the two of you. One of or other of you might have an idea that kind of sparks the other one.
Yeah, and I think that's the essence of a great band is where you're bouncing stuff off each other and you become greater than, the band becomes greater than the sum of its parts.
Yeah. Let's listen to a little bit of Hint Blue.
We reached the clearing and sat down. I could see that you've been crying.
That's Hint Blue from the new Bellex One album, Merciful Hour. And Paul Noonan, we should really be sending this out as a question, shouldn't we, to the listener? What instrument appears on that track that has never before appeared on a Bellex One album? I'd love to pretend I knew this, but you told me, Paul.
I did. It's the bouzouki, that it opens with.
Which you play yourself.
I did, yeah.
And what was the attraction of the bouzouki in that particular song?
I think I saw Donal Lunny play it in the flesh for the first time. And, I'd seen him play it on telly and listened to his records over the years. But seeing it in the flesh, he's got this wonderful drone going on that sort of anchors everything. I thought, I'll have a go with that.
Mm. And I was talking, Dom, at the beginning about, Paul and his various outside projects and Dave and his outside projects as well, your big outside projects. Ongoing, I believe, is the house build. Is it?
I'd say on 2 or 3 more thousand jobs, and it'll be all done.
It'll all be finished. Any year in plan, maybe for the 50th anniversary.
A year, you're
can't be tied to a year or a decade, maybe.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, I was checking with you. Had you been there from the very start? And you were telling me that yourself and Paul had gone to school together. I mean, was that love of music? Was that inherent? Could you see what direction you might head even at that point together, or were you blissfully unaware of where you were heading?
Blissfully unaware, I think. I just sort of meandered through, did various music projects or things came up within school, or then it just became outside and a few people got together and said, oh, let's form a band. Yeah, you do a bit. You can play bass, come on. Off you come.
Yeah.
And that kind of thing. And I never saw it as a realistic option, I guess. I always thought, this might be a bit of crack.
Yeah.
And then it was like, oh no, we're doing this for real. And I'm like, okay, I'll go along. And I thought, I'll do it for 6 months, see what happens.
Can you identify that moment, Paul, since we are 25 years on, can you identify the moment when you thought, no, this is actually a viable career path and we can do something with this?
I think, when we got together, it was that wonderfully formative time when you're falling in love with music with your friends. There's something really powerful about that. So we have never been particularly strategic about, and in 5 years time we see ourselves doing this, but I think again we're putting one foot in front of the other and making records that we love and trying to keep ourselves challenged.
Yeah, and I know that we have spoken before, and music therapy has become a part of your music practice, if you like, as well, which kind of brings another string to the bow. And I'm going to finish, in fact, with the final track of the album, which I must say, the latter half of the album broke my heart a couple of times today. Okay. I'm even getting well enough now thinking about it. But kind of from Still Singing down through As the Demons Have Their Say, Whisper in the Night, the track that we heard from Dave, and then this final track on the album, Light My Way. There's a real emotional heft as we get to the end. Maybe you'd give us a little bit of the background to Light My Way and we listen to a bit of it to finish up.
I've been making music with a man who has dementia in my work as a music therapist, and he is a big... He loves his birds and would always have been able to tell a bird by their call. And one day he said to me, those birds are—they're singing, but I can't really remember their names. And then he said, "But that's okay. They never knew mine." Making kind of fun and light of his unraveling in that sort of very, I was very moved by it, I suppose. And the song was a response to that.
Well, the being moved is there in the response. So I'll finish up by listening to a little bit of Light My Way.
Thank you.
these birds in the garden, they're singing all the time.
Just a little flavour then of the final song on the new Bellex One album, Merciful Hour, Light My Way. 6 minute song, and you got to listen to all 6 minutes and 21 seconds of it to really get into that, get into the emotion of it. Thank you so much to Paul Noonan, Dom Phillips, for coming to us this evening. Lovely to speak with both of you. The live shows around the country kicking off in Cork, live at the Marquee, June the 10th. And then there are various other places, Limerick, King John's Castle, Derry, the Stendhal Festival, the Ivy Gardens in Dublin already sold out, Laois at the Forest Festival, Galway International Arts Festival, and the Revival Festival in Listowel. So busy summer ahead. Thanks again to Paul Noonan, Dom Phillips from Bellex One. The new album, Merciful Hour, out tomorrow. And full details of all of the tour dates can be found on the website bellex1.com. And that is our lot for this Thursday evening. Leah Murphy and Paulie Shields research. Michelle Gibson was the broadcast coordinator. Ruth Kennington was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Reg Luby. Talk to you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock once again here on RT Radio 1. And I do believe that it is Ray. Ray Cuddy will be with you after the news.